Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of July. Our guest this hour is the author of the wildly popular Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire. Rafe Esquith is with us. His latest book is Lighting Their Fires, How Parents and Teachers Can Raise Extraordinary Kids. The Washington Post has called him the most interesting and influential classroom teacher in the country. The New York Times says he's a genius and a saint. He has taught at Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles for over 24 years and is the only teacher to have been awarded the President's National Medal of the Arts. Many other honors have come his way, including the American Teacher Award, Parents Magazine's As You Grow Award, Oprah Winfrey's Use Your Life Award, and People Magazine's Heroes Among Us Award. He lives in Los Angeles and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Rafe. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I love to read your books because I read them with a pen and paper next to me so I can write down all the books and all the movies that you suggest, because you suggest so many wonderful ones.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. You're also a big baseball fan, and you weave the story of going to the baseball game with the Dodgers and the Cardinals, I believe, with your students. And it's a whole different way to watch a baseball game. Can you talk about why you do that?
Well, I did it for several reasons. Number one, I wrote Lighting Their Fires because I think in this fast food society, even President Obama calls children on their race to the top. I don't think it's a race to the top. I think raising children takes a long time. And so I set the book in one night at a baseball game for two reasons. One, nothing magical happens in this night, Kathleen. Even though I teach the kids a lot of things, they don't get out of the car at the end of the evening and say, thank you, Ray, for saving my life. You know, that's the Hollywood movie version. It doesn't work that way. It's a long, long journey. And the reason I set it at a baseball game, I don't think there's anything more American than a baseball game, in that when a child is there, they see everything that's right about our country, but they also see everything that's wrong about our country. They have screens dominating their lives and music blasted at them and drunken fans yelling obscenities at the players. And I want the kids to see all the possibilities, both good and bad, and help them make good choices so they can become extraordinary.
Hmm. You also have fans throwing beach balls around and not paying attention to what's going on. And your students are pretty appalled by that. If you're there to watch a game, watch the game.
Well, everybody knows, I mean, who work with children, who are raising children, it seems that children don't focus the way they used to. We are constantly trying to get kids to pay attention, and that's because of a lot of the distractions that are thrown their way. So in the book, I'm giving parents suggestions of what I do with children. People are amazed that my kids not only pay attention closely, but they can do so for long periods of time.
Right.
And it doesn't happen overnight, but it's an important skill for kids to master, whether they want to be a baseball player or an architect. If they can focus on things, they're going to be more successful.
I love what you have to say, and let's spend some time talking about that now, about time, that your students realize the importance of time.
It's really true. We don't, you know, again, in schools, we're spending so much time working on their test scores, and what's the answer to number 23, A, B, C, or D, that we're missing the big picture. And I really work with kids on looking at their day, at the 24 hours and how they're going to spend that day. And I don't want them to make choices because I tell them to. I want to teach them to internalize a set of values where they start making good choices in how they spend their time. And it doesn't mean that they have to spend 27 hours a day, you know, studying Hamlet. I do want them to work really hard, but I also want them to have time, you know, to play in the mud and throw water balloons at each other. And most children these days are now spending, they're saying, approximately 7 hours a day in front of a television set.
Mm-hmm.
Well, surely I don't think anybody thinks that's a good way for them to spend their time. The key is not to simply take the television away from them, but to get the kids to understand, turn off your own television set because I have better ways of spending my time. And that's what I teach children.
And your students who have worked with you in the past come back sometimes to speak to your students and frequently say to them, turn off your television.
It's really true. A great part of the success of my classroom, I'm starting my 26th year here at Hobart Elementary School, and I have an army of former students who are very successful in their careers in high school and college, and they come back and talk to the children all the time. They're an integral part of the classroom, and those role models have a much greater effect on the children than I do.
Mm-hmm. I was interested just in reading about the extra effort, the extra mile that you go for your students, and you are an extraordinary teacher in that you keep going, don't you? Teaching, in order to be very effective, is an around-the-clock kind of job, as far as you're concerned.
Well, first of all, I certainly don't expect teachers to do what I do, because I'm probably certifiably crazy. But I admit it. But what I am asking teachers and parents to do is to maybe refocus the conversation. Surely, we have to be the people we want the kids to be. And parents often want their kids not to watch so much television. But if you're sitting in front of your television and telling your child to go read, that's a mixed message.
Mm-hmm.
I've raised four children, and they're all voracious readers, and that's because we read together every night. One of the tips in the book is good parents often read with their children when they're young, but then when the kids start school, they think, okay, I don't really have to read with them anymore because they're doing reading in school. But the fact is they're not, and they're not doing joyous reading in school. So as a parent, I read with my children every night. We had a family reading hour all the way through high school. And I want parents to understand just because they're going to school doesn't mean you shouldn't be teaching them. And they've got to be the people they want their kids to be. If we want our kids to be kind, then we have to be the kindest people they've ever met. And the kids watch us constantly. And that's why at the baseball game, when the kids see people hurling obscenities, I don't do that. And even when they hurl them at me for asking them to stop hurling obscenities, I don't hurl them back. I want them to see that not everybody has to behave in that manner.
Right. The thing that has always struck me about your classroom, I just don't think there are many fifth grade classrooms who do Shakespeare and have the members of the Royal Shakespeare Company come in and look at your productions and help your students. We're talking fifth grade students here, Rafe.
And fifth graders who don't speak English as their first language.
Oh, my gosh. Let's add to that. I know.
Well, it's funny. As we speak right now, it's a little after 8 in the morning here in Los Angeles. And starting at 7 this morning, 40 students have come in this summer who aren't even in my class yet. They don't even know if they're going to be in my class, because they want to study Shakespeare.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're up in the room right now studying with my former students. And the point is this, not that everybody should do Shakespeare, but parents and teachers need to share their passions with children. And what's happening in the schools now is that in this craze of standardization, every classroom is supposed to look the same, every child is supposed to be reading the same book, and good young teachers, and Kathleen, they're really good, they are being forced to follow a script, and they stop being themselves. What I'm trying to encourage young teachers to do is that if you're a great gardener, try to garden with your children for part of the day. Try and synthesize the state standards with what you're doing so that your passions are passed on to the children. I love Shakespeare, rock and roll, and baseball, and they're all integral parts of my classroom, even though they're not part of the California curriculum. It's not that I replaced it. I supplemented the curriculum. That's why people ask, how do I get away with this stuff? It's because I do everything that the school asks me to do. I just do a few extra things, and Shakespeare's my guy. And yes, every year the kids do an unabridged production of Shakespeare, and people cross oceans just to be in that room. It's quite a remarkable night.
It is remarkable. I just love the fact that you do that. And you might also add that you're a fan of great movies, too, because I wrote a movie list down, and I was talking to my son last night. Oh, have you seen this? We need to look at that.
It's fun. Well, you know, again, if you're 10 years old or 15 years old, you turn on your radio or television, and the ads for the latest movie come out, and, you know, the ads will tell you it's the greatest movie of all time, or it's the number one movie. Everybody has seen this movie. Have you? But the truth is, most of these movies aren't that good. And the reason we know they're not good is what I teach children about film and about excellence in general is that a great film or a great book passes the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true that maybe a movie like Pirates of the Caribbean makes $1 billion. But will anybody study this film 10 years from now? Will anybody look at it as cinematic excellence? There's nothing wrong with watching it. But I don't want my kids to think that's a great film when they haven't seen a film like The Wizard of Oz or Citizen Kane or Casablanca or On the Waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
Films which are extraordinary. And it's not that the kids are stupid. They've never heard of these films.
Hmm.
So it's like you said, you made a list with your son, and it's fun to watch with the children to expose them to great ideas and great values.
We had the great pleasure, and I was so happy to read in your book that this is mandatory viewing in your class, to interview Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird earlier this week. And I was thinking about the enormous impact of that film. And
So you interviewed Mary Badham?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
See, you react the same way.
How lucky are you? That's fantastic.
I felt the same way, and so did people in our audience.
Sure.
And that's a true sense of who we are, who listen to public radio, to all have that great enthusiasm about interviewing Scout.
I got chills. That's great.
But seeing that film is an incredibly influential experience. If you're going to spend time watching film or reading books, not that you always will, but why not read something or watch something that matters?
I agree. And the other thing that's fun with my classes, To Kill a Mockingbird is kind of the Bible of my classroom, and Atticus is my personal hero.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny is when the kids watch the film, they love the film. But they always say, yeah, but the book is better because they had to cut out this scene and this scene and this scene. And because my kids are real readers, they can love a film but also view it critically and have conversations about what they liked or what they didn't like. They really watch it with knowledge. And it's an extraordinary film, and she gave an amazing performance for a little kid.
Yes, she did.
Amazing.
I want to go back to those students who don't even know if they're going to be in your classroom yet, who at 7 this morning...
Oh, some of them were here by 6:15.
Oh, my gosh. Went to school to learn Shakespeare. People's mouths are dropping as they listen to you say that. How do you get them to do that?
Well, that's another key thing that I'm trying to say in this book. It takes a long time. I have 1,000 visitors to my classroom a year from all over the world, and many good young teachers come in, and their mouths drop when they see these kids who are completely independent, who don't look to me for guidance, who work their tails off and laugh all day, and who are really kind to each other, and they say, I want this class, and I want it right now.
Yeah.
And I tell them, well, you can't have it right now. I didn't have it right now. In my second or third year of teaching, my class didn't look like this. I tried to get better. I tried to watch other good teachers and learn from my mistakes. But what happened is because I've stayed put for a long time, I have a reputation in the community now where kids have been waiting since the first grade to try and be a part of Shakespeare because they've heard other kids talk about how much fun they had and how it helped them in their lives. But originally, the initial group of Hobart Shakespeareans was only 5 children. When I, you know, in 1986, when I told the class, hey, let's stay after school and learn Shakespeare... and come on Saturdays and come during your vacations, they looked at me like, what, are you a lunatic? Some dead white guy? I'm not going to learn this guy. And there were only 5 kids. Now, when you open the door of my classroom, kids fall out the door because there are so many kids who want to be a part of it because it's really not about Shakespeare. That's the point of this book. They're learning things not just to be in a play, but to learn things that are going to help them for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
If you learn how to be a member of a team or you learn how to speak well in front of people, or learn to speak language beautifully, or play music, or work together with others. That has nothing to do with Shakespeare. You can learn the same thing in a soccer team. But these are the skills that I'm talking about that we have forgotten to have a part of the school curriculum and sometimes a part of the home curriculum. And I want people to start thinking about what really matters.
You spend some time, a lot of time actually, in the book, eloquently defending the importance of music and playing an instrument of some kind while you're a student. Why do you feel so strongly about music?
Well, the funny thing is I didn't know this, Kathleen, when I started teaching. I'm a math guy. I was a math major at UCLA. And early in my career, many of the students during the day had to leave my classroom because we have an orchestra. And they'd say, Rafe, we have to leave now and go to orchestra. And I used to get upset, not with them, but just saying, oh, man, they're missing my class. Now I'm going to have to reteach them things, catch them up. What I found was the kids who went to orchestra were doing better than the kids who didn't. And I thought, how could this be? I mean, they're missing my classroom and doing better. Because when you're young, you think you're the center of the universe.
Of course.
Of course you're not. So I started to walk and watch them in the orchestra, and I realized what they were really learning in the orchestra was focus and listening to other people and practicing on their own and sometimes making mistakes. You know, you play a bad note, and you have to fix that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Or to play something so challenging you can't play it yet, but with practice you master it. And then I thought to myself, well, if this is helping them that way and they go 2 days a week, if they have music with me every day, think of how amazing they're going to become. So I started to learn about music. I started to learn to play instruments. And now it's the glue that holds my classroom together, so much so that if I were President Obama's Secretary of Education, the first thing I would do is make music training, music education, a mandatory requirement, it's not an elective the way it is in schools, I would have all children from kindergarten playing music all the time.
Has Arnie Duncan been to your classroom?
No, I think Mr. Duncan and I would have an interesting conversation.
I know you would. That's why I think you should see your classroom.
Because he's all about test scores.
Yeah.
And that's a shortcut. I'm sorry to say this. I know he works hard, and I respect him. But to simply say, hey, look, this kid has 80, therefore he used to have 75, and he's doing better.
I know.
I'm sorry. That's not true.
Right.
Not to mention the fact, and this is a whole other situation, but even the test scores that you hear about in the newspapers and stuff, they're not often accurate. They're often inflated. They're not standardized tests. There are all of these tests are given in classrooms with only a teacher proctoring it. So they're not a true reflection of what's going on in the school, but it makes certain people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, it's not that simple.
Right. And there's nothing about, when you look at test scores, the joy of discovering something that you're passionate about and you'll spend your life doing it. And that's what school is about, to help you find out what...
Well, it's supposed to be about that.
Right.
You know, I often use this argument. People are listening to us this morning. They may agree with what I have to say or disagree. They may find me interesting. They may find me boring. But they're not basing their judgments on my test scores. These test scores that we're telling these children that this is the be-all and end-all of your existence, that's absurd.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many lies we tell children that, like, that the college they choose is the most important choice they'll ever make. I'm sorry, that's not true. And listen, my students go to college. I love the fact that they go to college. But to tell a child that you can't go to Fresno State because you must go to Princeton,
right?
That's absurd. And a lot of kids are getting those messages, and it shouldn't be happening.
Right. Let's welcome phone calls for you, Rafe. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Rafe's latest book is Lighting Their Fires, How Parents and Teachers Can Raise Extraordinary Kids in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. And it's, in addition to all the wonderful stories about the students he teaches, it's worth getting just to get a list of all the books and films that are recommended in this marvelous book. He's the author, you'll recall, also of Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire. So here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org. You can also follow us on Facebook on The Kathleen Dunn Show. I am Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, and let's start with Mary from Michigan. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to say two little things. First thing is that written music is a graph. And the second thing is a comment about another book from a few years ago, Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids, chapter one, and especially just about, well, I would almost call it mental hygiene, keeping the mind clear.
Sounds good.
So that's pretty much it. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. I can't remember the young student's name. Tell me about the student who discovered pottery.
Oh, Joanna. Oh, my gosh.
That's a great story.
Oh, well, she's amazing. I just talked to her the other day. She's at Brown University now. And when she was in middle school, she was at a school which, you know, very much on math and science and reading, which is all great. But she took an elective in pottery, and by taking that elective, she found out what she truly loves to do. And she has a real talent for pottery. I mean, a real talent. So much so that she made a deal with the janitors of her school to let her stay till midnight, working at her wheel, quietly focusing. And her stuff now is, it's what you would see in Beverly Hills art galleries. I mean, it's beautiful. But the best thing is, she never sells it. She's studying, she just is studying to be a curator at a museum, at an art museum. And she's worked at the Getty here in Los Angeles, and she just worked in both France and Korea at different museums. But she continues to make pottery, and she's 21 years old. She makes it because she loves it. And it's you were talking about the joy. It has nothing to do with, even though she could make a fortune doing it, that's not why she does. She loves the art of it. She loves spending time creating and relaxing and making things for her home or for her friends. And again, she tried something not in the basic curriculum, and found out something she loves to do, and now she does it for the rest of her life. And she's so much happier for doing it.
Yes. Thank you, Mary, for your call. Charlie is next from Oregon. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I thought I might share with you an experience. I served on the Oregon School Board for about 9 years and had three kids who graduated from Oregon. My oldest changed her major her sophomore year at Harvard from pre-law to dramatic literature and stage history. And we were involved, my wife and I were both involved with the choral music program as sort of a choral boosters program. We had occasion to take kids to on tour. On one occasion, we were taking them to St. Louis to perform at St. Louis Cathedral, and overnight we stayed at Milken University, and we were spending the night in sleeping bags on a gym floor without air mattresses. And I was talking to one of the kids and asked what they were learning in school that really seemed to be important and significant. And one of the kids said something that really blew me away. He said, you know, theater and music are the only places in school where I've begun to learn what it means to be human.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's so true.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I learned the same. We're all learning it. But I think, sadly, you know, when Kathleen mentioned Arne Duncan before, you never hear him talk about these things.
No.
And it has to be a part of the conversation. Parents like you and children like yours have to get involved with this because those are the things that kids remember most of all. By the way, the kids and I just came back from Oregon because we spend 12 days at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival every year in Ashland, and it's just a great 12 days.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? Thank you, Charlie, very much for the call. And you do, when you think about your teachers, I'm sure many remember you, but you think about the teachers who had that, you know, who took what it was that they had, be it, you know, getting people together, piecework that they were doing, or people who really loved baseball, or they loved Shakespeare, or they loved Dickens, or they loved, who knows?
Cooking, anything.
Yeah, exactly. But they imparted that, and that you learned things through that. That's, they had life about them.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, well, I'm with you. All right, Mary in Palmyra. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the remark that I really think what the problem, too, is we just don't have enough teachers that have the passion and desire that you obviously have for children, and you incorporate that into your teaching. You really, really care about the kids. And obviously, the kids reciprocate. They can see that from you. I wish I would have had a teacher like you when I was growing up.
It is. You know, it's funny, Mary. The great Shakespearean actor Ian McKellen taught me that tragedy isn't just something that's bad. It's something that could be really good and turns out bad. That's why it's tragic. The tragedy that I see is I see hundreds and hundreds and thousands of great young teachers who could be the teachers that you're talking about. But the system crushes them. They come in with good ideas, and instead, they're treated badly in the school, or the kids are really incorrigible, and they get no backup to help them with discipline. And because of that, after 2 or 3 years, they give up. There's a huge turnover in schools now, and the problem is teachers have to understand that to have the kind of classroom I have, it's going to take them many, many years. And what happens is it doesn't happen their first couple of years, and they give up. It's not that they don't have the passion, they do, but it gets crushed pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the system is just working against that kind of teaching, too. When you've got tests that you have to administer and your school has to look at how well you performed on those tests and then maybe you get some extra money for the school, it's a whole different way of evaluating your success.
Let me tell you an even more horrific aspect of the testing that I'm sure none of your visitors even considered. This year in school, I was walking down the hallway, and I saw two fourth-grade teachers, and Kathleen, they're good. Hmm. They're the kind of teachers that Mary wants her kids to have. They're young, they're passionate, and they work very hard. But they're honest. Now, as fourth-grade teachers, they had third-graders come to their classroom with last year's test scores, and the test scores showed that their children were advanced. They're not. Nowhere near it. They're way behind. What happened is there was cheating going on.
Oh.
And now they're in this bind. When they test their kids honestly, the scores will be lower, and then people will say, oh, you're bad teachers. So they're being punished for being honest. And they were crying to me, saying, what in the world do we do? We don't want to be dishonest in the way we administer tests, but we don't want to look bad. And this is the nightmare when testing becomes everything.
Yes. Thank you, Mary. Eric in Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, good morning, Kathleen. A pleasure to talk to you again. I bought your guest's first book, Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire.
Mm-hmm.
and it's also great, has a lot of anecdotes for parenting. What you accept, you teach, quote unquote.
Thank you.
And also a past guest who wrote Wimpy Parenting, Wimpy Parents.
Sure.
Yeah. These two books together are great parenting books. But every once in a while I'll give a talk at church, and they think I'm a lunatic because I tell them parenting, you know, what you accept, teach. And you teach by example.
Absolutely.
And they look at it, well, gee whiz, what are we to do? You know, and I said, these are the two means, is, you know, a parent. All the rest kind of fits in. But your latest book, I'm going to get a copy of it. I'm not even going to ask the price. I'm going to buy it.
It's in paperback, so you got a deal.
It's cheap.
Listen, I tell you, your commentary just before you took my call is a sad commentary of our time. I used to call on teachers for many years.
Right.
And I watched a lot of good ones just get chewed up.
Sure.
And,
absolutely. I see it every day.
And
they're good, Eric. They're really good. They could be great.
Exactly.
One interesting thing that you should know, when I wrote Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire, I thought I was writing a little cookbook for teachers. I didn't know it would be an international bestseller. It's in languages all over the world.
Mm.
But the most interesting thing was that the thousands of letters I got were not from teachers. It was from parents like Eric saying, we love this book. Can you write a book that has to do more with what we can do at home?
Oh, interesting.
That helps our kids be more like the kids in your class. That's why I wrote Lighting Their Fires. It was like a world demand.
Hmm. Isn't it? What did that say to you, that the book, and this one too, that you all of a sudden became somebody people wanted to listen to and the books were so popular? What was it saying?
I'll tell you what it said to me. All these people, there are certain common things, which is we know that the world is really messed up at times, that our kids are being assaulted by imagery that we don't want them to see. What in the world do we do? Because we feel that no one speaks for us. All these parents, I thought I was the only one who felt this way. And the truth is millions of people feel this way, except that they're not in power. So
yes.
You don't see them on the news. I mean, it is, I don't mean to offend anybody, but when we're growing up in a society where a basketball player takes 4 hours on television to announce where he's
going. Oh, my gosh. Could you believe that?
I mean,
I know.
What does that say?
I know.
Our values.
I know.
I mean, I like basketball. You know, I like to watch a good basketball game, but come on.
I know.
And that's why it is a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. And it's up to us to tell the kids, you know what? This is not that important.
Thanks very much, Eric, for the call. Scott in Union Grove. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I'm 45 years old, and I'm starting college this fall to pursue a career in teaching.
Yay!
Hey, yeah.
Yes, and I know that 99% of the people I talk to says I'm a fool, and but you know I spent 5 years on a school board up in Westfield, and I got my eyes opened up quite a bit and realized, because in my past, I was one of those that thought, you know, teachers are overpaid, they're underworked, and all that kind of stuff. And I got an opportunity to see it from a different perspective, and so much so that I've decided to, you know, change my career path completely and go into something that I think I can, you know, think I can offer.
Oh, Scott, that's great.
Welcome, Scott.
What have you done before? What field?
What have I done before? Let's see. I've been in the Marine Corps. I own a resort up in Wisconsin. I own a construction company. I drive a truck right now. I think it's the broad background that I can bring, that I travel all over.
Great.
You know, I have two children of my own now who...
even better.
You know, now I've seen what, you know, what quality teaching, quality schools can do for them. And it's just, you know, it's just been... one of those things that's been brewing inside me for years. I just finally decided to take the plunge, and so I'll be starting at Northern Illinois University here August 23rd.
That's a great school.
Yeah,
I'm wonderful.
From Wisconsin to Illinois, and in the last couple of years, I spent 14 years up here, and like I said, our Westfield School District, though small and poor, has done a fantastic job with the resources they have.
Great. Mm-hmm.
And so I decided, you know what, it's time for me to step up to the plate and offer up what I had to offer. And
that's a great story, Scott.
Can I give you one bit of advice?
In these books, anytime you can, again,
right.
Watch some other teacher or learn from somebody else, you can pass it along. So
yes, right. No, don't go away. You wanted to give him advice, right?
Yeah, Scott, the one thing I want you to remember is that when you have bad days in school, and you will have them, because this is a really tough job,
mm-hmm.
on those days where you think, gee, I'm not making a difference, you don't know that. Mm-hmm. Because many times I've learned lessons that I thought were falling on deaf ears, kicked in 5 years later, 10 years later. I just got a letter from a kid that I taught 22 years ago. I hadn't seen him in 22 years. He was a very troubled kid. He wrote to me about his tough experiences with a single parent traveling around the country living off of food stamps. And it's funny, you're a Marine, because he then joined the Marines. Then he passed the bar. He's now a member of, he's a lawyer for the United States Circuit Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote to me that it was what he learned in the fifth grade that kept him going.
Hmm.
And I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So on those days when you think you're not making a difference, you are. It's just not as simple as a Hollywood movie.
And the other message is be sure to let those teachers know.
Yeah, no,
write to them later.
Those letters sustain me.
Yes, they. That's a wonderful story. Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Catherine is next in Madison. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. About 10 years ago, I was in AmeriCorps, and I was supposed to go in as a one-on-one reading tutor and an enrichment program, bring things in. And they stuck me, and I say stuck because I have learning disabilities, into the classroom as
wow.
a paraprofessional.
Yep.
They made me go to the paraprofessional meetings and the teachers' meetings, which meant I was in the thick of the politics because the paras hated me. It was just, like, totally impossible.
Sure.
I didn't have the skill set to be in the kindergarten class and do phonics. You know, it's like I have learning disabilities.
Right.
So I, in order, and I tried to fight all year, and it just didn't work. So what I did was subversive things. I, even though the paras would get mad at me, I brought in cookbooks into the lunchroom. And I would bring in an ethnic cookbook, and then I'd say, what do your parents do for a holiday? I brought in a magazine with decorating, and one little Mexican boy said to me, I want that chair. And I said, you can have it. You can buy it secondhand when you're older, and you can upholster it. I mean, I looked to get the joy of learning that the teachers
sure.
teaching to the test didn't have time. And
right.
talk about cheating. They had us proctor the state test, which was illegal.
I know. Believe me, I see this all the time.
Mm.
Yeah, they did things like that all the time. So I just looked for these little creative ways, and I think maybe even if paraprofessionals did that, they would feel better.
They would. And by the way, here's something for you to remember. If anybody's ever mad at you, I always tell people, Socrates was the best teacher who ever lived, and they killed him. So if anybody's mad at you, you're probably doing a good job.
Thank you, Catherine, so much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is the author now of Lighting Their Fires, How Parents and Teachers Can Raise Extraordinary Kids in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. Rafe Esqueeth is with us. He has been teaching at Hobart Elementary School in L.A. He's into his 26th year. He's won many, many awards for his work as an outstanding teacher. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. I gave you the number, the email talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Esqueeth is our guest, and the book is Lighting Their Fires, How Parents and Teachers Can Raise Extraordinary Kids in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. You know, Socrates didn't commit suicide. I mean, he did commit suicide. They didn't kill him. He had an option. He could have walked. But more importantly, when I was giving tests years ago in the classroom, they were standardized. We were instructed to go around. If the kids couldn't do it, we were to help point out the correct answers. And now I know that there was many charismatic people in this business. One lady in Chicago, if you recall, a while back, she was great. She was teaching Shakespeare.
I think you mean Marva Collins.
Yeah, and then there was a guy in Texas. They even made a popular movie about it. He was a math teacher in a barrio somewhere and was able to bring these kids up to the highest standard and teach them calculus.
I think you mean Jaime Escalante in Los Angeles, who just passed away.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Sorry to hear that. But here's the deal. It may be that school teachers, like sex appeal, are charismatic, and you can't bottle it and sell it in a book. Now, you can give people ideas, but you're never going to make me immortal, handsome, rich by me reading your book. So I agree that we should read the book to see if we can expand our talent, but I don't expect to be you.
Well, let me tell you, first of all, you shouldn't be me, but to tell you something funny about how uncharismatic I am, the funniest story I ever tell people, I say this in every speech I ever give, is that years ago, Oprah Winfrey gave me her Use Your Life Award. But before she does that, I didn't know that she hires a private investigator to follow you.
Oh, really?
Because people scam her. They lie to her about their accomplishments to try and sell books or whatever. So one day I'm teaching math, and a guy walked into my classroom. Nice guy, three-piece suit. And I thought he was a teacher. I said, can I help you? And he said, no, I'm not one of your teacher admirers, Rafe. I'm a private investigator. And I've never talked to anybody I've tailed before, but I wanted to talk to you. It's kind of a good news, bad news thing. He said, the good news is you're about to win Oprah Winfrey's Angel Award, and you're an extraordinary teacher, and you've got the coolest class I've ever seen. He said, but the bad news is you're the most boring man I've ever followed in my
Rafe!
life. He said, you don't do anything. He said, you go home to your wife and kids, you don't go to the movies, you don't go anywhere. You just teach all day. So I don't mean to disagree with your guest, but I am so ordinary, and I'm not charismatic at all. When I speak and people clap, my class laughs. They're like, what's the fuss? It's just Rafe. So, there are, I agree with you, there are charismatic teachers that, like, wow their classrooms. That's really not me. But I do want to say one thing that you can do with your students. And here's a great point. If you ask most children, they're working on their math or they're working on an essay, and you say, why are you doing this? Most kids will say either, I don't know, or they'll say, because my teacher told me to, or because there's a test on Friday. I teach my kids something we can all teach our children. My kids will tell you if they're working on something, if I know this skill, my life just got better. We're here to help you have a better life, to show you skills that you're going to be using in your life. I don't think you have to be a charismatic teacher or parent to have that conversation with the child.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're underrating yourself because I just hear your voice. I'm not seeing you, and you have and have read your book. And so you've got this genuine quality about you. You care. You really care, which is you're enthusiastic, and you have exquisite taste.
Thank you.
And that's important.
I also have a brilliant wife. Let's not leave her out.
You what?
I have a brilliant wife. She's really the brains behind our classroom.
Is she a teacher?
No, she's my best teacher. She's a retired nurse. But it was really Barbara who 25 years ago, when I could have been one of those young teachers to buy into the testing and get the kids to 90 because therefore you're a good teacher, it was Barbara who gave me a slap and said, Rafe, if you're not creating good people, then you're not doing anything. And I said, Barbara, you know, creating honorable kids in this world, that's harder. And Barbara said, well, Rafe, then your job's harder.
Right.
That's just the way it is.
And it is. It is one hard job.
It is a hard job. You know, I also want to point out to you, you were mentioning Mockingbird before. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, why do the kids call me Rafe instead of Mr. Esquith? And the reason they call me Rafe is because Atticus's kids called him Atticus.
Oh.
And he's my role model. If his kids can call him by the first name, I think my kids can call me by my first name.
Oh. Thanks, Mike, for the call. More phone calls with Tom in Green Bay. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'm very excited to get this opportunity to talk to your guest. We have a teacher at Pulaski. We just got back from Estes Park with the band.
Sure.
They played at the Grand Lake Barbecue Festival, and then they went to Mount Rushmore and played at Mount Rushmore, and then they played at Crazy Horse.
Oh, I was just going to ask if they went there. It's fantastic.
And the neat thing about it is one of the assistant teachers, band teachers that was with him, he's teaching at another school at Seymour, and their program isn't as dynamic as our music program.
Right.
And he invited the kids from that program to join our band on this tour.
Oh, wow.
And to get their program to get boosted
right.
up so that people get excited about it and get the kids excited about the music program so that they can become as good as our program is.
Well, but, that collaboration is crucial, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I agree 100%. You know, you have to share your passion. As you said, passion's an important thing, but you also have to share your passion.
You know, all my good ideas have come from other teachers who work with me. That's one of the things, you know, you say, Kathleen, you say I underrate myself. I'm really just trying to be really honest that most of the good ideas I had came from other teachers. And I'll give you one example. People are amazed that my children all know sign language. When we sing, we often sign the songs that we're singing. Well, I don't know that, but there was a really great teacher at my school named Mrs. Hayden, and I saw her signing with her kids because she used to work with the deaf, and I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So I said, can you work with my class? And again, like Tom said, because she's passionate, she said she'd love to work with my class. And one of the great things that happened, not only do all my kids know how to sign now and love learning to sign, here's even a better thing. When we're in Washington, D.C. now, and we're like riding the metro, and it's crowded, and the kids want to talk, but they don't want to disturb people who are reading their magazines. They sign each other. So they're quiet in public, and they still communicate.
That's
and again,
wonderful.
People come up to me, and they go, gee, Rafe, you're a great teacher. And I go, yeah, I guess. I asked Mrs. Hayden to show my class something. I guess that makes me special.
And she was a great teacher, too, because she said yes.
Well, that's what Tom is saying. Really good teachers, they love to share things. I love to share my ideas with Shakespeare. Many of my art ideas came from this brilliant art teacher I know, who gives me help all the time. I ask for help, and I'm not ashamed to do so.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. We go next to Nancy in Madison. Hi, Nancy. Nancy, are you there? I'm sorry, Nancy. We go to Bill in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. I'm just looking for comments. I'm very invested in public education. I think that our public schools are great and should be made greater. But one thing that was kind of discouraging to me when my child was going through the system is that a lot of the teachers sent their children to private or parochial schools rather than have their own kids in the public system. I'd just like a comment from the guest.
Okay.
You're absolutely right, but I'm proud to tell you that I have four children who all went to public school all the way through, and they're all college graduates. And I agree with you that, yes, public education is in deep trouble. But if we run from it, how are we going to fix it? And people ask me, why do I stay? Because I get amazing offers to start my own school or to go to
sure.
private school. I believe in what your guest is saying. We are in this together. And yes, I'm the biggest critic of public schools. It's a mess right now. But it's fixable. It's fixable. But we have to change the conversation. We have to change the way we're measuring success. So I will tell you that all of my children went to public school.
Well, it's so American, too, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, the idea that the child who goes to a public school may one day cure cancer, and your tax dollars may wind up coming back to help you. It helps all of us.
Right.
And I'm not, believe me, public schools have all the problems you've heard about are true. But you also don't hear about, like, the great kids who are upstairs right now, public school kids in a poor neighborhood who are giving up their summer because they want to be here. We don't hear stories like that. And we should.
Yes, we should. Yes, we should. Beth in Richland Center, hi.
Good morning. Kathleen and Rafe, I cannot tell you how excited I am to hear this interview. I'm just practically jumping up and down. I come from a family of educators on my dad's side. I began creating and designing curriculum and teaching when I was 6, 7 years old.
Oh.
Yeah, seriously, I could tell you all about it. I remember the program that I designed and implemented, upon my little brother. So, you know, that's pedagogy for you. Of course, I grew up to be a teacher. What else would I possibly do except maybe rule the world? But since have morphed into working, I would say, in a way parallel with public education and other educational modes, because I do what is referred to in a general sense as energy psychology, and I see myself still as an educator, and most of all as a catalyst, and that's what I want to say to you. You aren't dull, sir. You are not flashy and cheesy, perhaps, but you are definitely not dull. You are a catalyst.
Thank
if you remember your chemistry, you know exactly how...
I have to know my chemistry. I have a daughter who's a chemist.
Okay, so you know exactly how brilliantly important a catalyst is, and also that the catalyst gets the heck out once it has done its part.
Oh, thank you for saying
yes.
That is
and the process
really important
always
part.
Belongs to the student.
Yes. How come we can't figure that out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's a funny story I tell all the time. When there were a group of young teachers in my classroom watching kids build a rocket, and they went rushing over to the kids, and I said, "Where are you going?" And teachers whispered to me, and they said, "Rafe, they're building it wrong." And I said, "Yes, they are." And they said, "It's not going to fly." And I said, "No, it won't." Then they're going to have to figure out why. It's called science. Don't do it for them. And you're right. Get out of the way.
Thank you, Beth, so much for your great call. Tom in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 38-year veteran principal.
Oh, there's a hero.
The last 3 years I was on the job, I put in place a one-to-one laptop program that provided my students with a powerful computing machine 24/7, and the creativity and the initiative that students exhibited, as well as staff, with that,
It's okay.
And the laptop was just a fantastic addition. Rafe, what you had to say today is so complimentary to how I felt. And with the laptops in the students' and teachers' hands, we saw creativity expand exponentially.
Oh, of course, you know, I laugh. Thank you for the compliment. The thing that I was laughing at is I think what we're talking about is common sense, except common sense isn't that common anymore, which is why I have to write about it to remind people what you're talking about. Let kids create, and let's give them the tools to help them create, and an environment in which they feel safe creating.
Thank you so much, Tom, for your call. Nancy is, I think, with us now. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Hey, Nancy.
Hi. I have a question for you, and I just wanted to preface it by saying I'm not a huge opponent of standardized testing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they could be designed much better.
Sure.
And I think that there's no payoff for the students. There's a payoff for the school, but whether the student succeeds or fails is one of the problems. And a good test can actually teach children how to manage competition.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering how you can...
I'm not an opponent of standardized testing. I test my kids all the time. Let me just say this. I tell the kids, look, if I've taught you how to multiply, of course I'm going to give you a test, but let's make sure why you're taking the test. You're taking it because I want to find out what you know and what you don't know. And if you don't know something, I'm just going to teach you again. A test is a thermometer.
How can you teach children to be competent, decent competitors in our society?
Absolutely. Great question. Well, for several reasons. One, we play a lot of sports, and we play to win. I mean, we play hard, but we also learn that the people we're playing are not the enemy. They're your opponent. And after the game, you go out for a Coke and then say, good job. You don't have to taunt each other.
Uh-huh.
Kids, you know, but it is competition, and competition is healthy. And I do have to tell the children, you know what, there's a reason that somebody bats third in your lineup. One of the lessons that we're lying to children about is we tell children, you're all equal. They're not.
Yes.
They're not all equal. If anybody's ever seen me paint, how bad I am, and people who are really good at it, there are some people who are better at it than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that competition, where kids start to learn where they're strong and where they're weak and how we have to strengthen our weaknesses, is a very healthy thing. I have no problem with giving a test. I just don't want children to think that their life is over if they do badly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on in schools. I see kids crying over these tests. Surely a nine-year-old. I've seen schools where kindergartners are chanting the year they're going to college. Come on, five. They can't even find their belly button yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's just keep things in perspective.
Well,
How's that, Nancy? Is that fair?
Thank you so much. Thanks for the call. We should put, do you have a list together of all the books and movies you recommend in your book?
Yeah, I have a lot of it in Lighting Their Fires. At the end of each chapter, there's like suggestions to parents.
Oh, are there?
Yeah, there's a section called the backpack.
Right,
Where we say what you can put in your child's backpack. It's a metaphor.
Yes.
And in each skill that we're teaching, whether it's humility or selflessness or focus, there are suggestions inning by inning. The book is divided into innings because we're at a baseball game.
You know? I know. And having a darn good time. Well, Rafe, thank you so much for being with us. When did the last... I'm trying to remember when I last interviewed you. When did the first book come out?
Well, the first book was called There Are No Shortcuts, and that was a long time ago, which we didn't do.
Uh-huh.
But we were together for 3 years ago for Teach Like Your Hero's on Fire.
Right. It was 3 years ago.
And now it's lighting their fires, and it's been just a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I'll bet. Rafe, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Our guest, author of Lighting Their Fires, How Parents and Teachers Can Raise Extraordinary Kids in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. Rafe Esquith is our guest, and you spell his name R-A-F-E. The last name is spelled E-S-Q-U-I-T-H, entering his 26th year of teaching at Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles, and has won all kinds of awards for his teaching and for inspiration. Thanks for listening.